This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening, especially to our new listeners on Washington, D.C.'s WAMU, WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, listeners in Cincinnati and St. Louis, and on KUAR in Little Rock, Arkansas. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Well, we begin this hour in Egypt, where in a desperate last-minute appeal to protesters, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi said he would give his life to defend the legitimacy of the Constitution, and he reminded Egyptians that he came to power through a free and fair democratic election. Listen.
I was selected and elected by the people in fair, transparent elections. Constitution was drafted. A state is in place.
It was a defiant speech that aired on television throughout Egypt around midnight on Tuesday. Morsi blamed unrest in the streets on corruption and said the youth are being manipulated.
What's taking place at the moment, that some are taking advantage of the anger of the youth. This anger is lawful and natural.
Now, the speech came just hours before an ultimatum issued by the military in Egypt is set to expire. The army says Morsi must find some roadmap to peace or they will set a new way forward. Following Morsi's speech, the army posted a message on its Facebook page under the title Final Hours. The statement read, "We swear to God that we will sacrifice even our blood for Egypt and its people to defend them against any terrorist, radical, or fool." Meanwhile, protests continued throughout the country. Joining us now is Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. Hi, Shadi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
A defiant speech, as we just heard there from Mohamed Morsi, the military poised to act. What do we know about their actual plans? There's a lot of different reporting and a lot of questions in Egypt about what the military will actually do.
Yeah, there's a lot of rumors and speculation going around. I think there's two possible scenarios that are worth looking at. One is an all-out military coup where effectively the military forces Morsi to leave regardless of his own wishes. But because of Morsi's defiance, they would literally have to remove him physically from the office. That could require arresting Morsi in the palace with armed guards. So that would be a very explicit military coup and one that would be very provocative, not just to Egyptians, but to the international community. So that's kind of the scary nightmare scenario. What could happen if cooler heads prevail is the military sponsors and backs a kind of national dialogue process where they say to Morsi and other political actors, you guys have to sit together and hash out your differences. There's no other option. And we're going to be pushing you in that direction. That could be more acceptable, and that could give a way for Morsi and the military to save face. They could both get some of what they want in that kind of scenario. But we're in a situation where both sides are playing a very dangerous game of brinksmanship. The Brotherhood is coming out with some very strong, defiant language where you have people saying that they're ready to lose their lives, telling supporters to be prepared to leave their wives and children, talking about martyrdom, standing in front of tanks and being shot at. They're using this kind of language. I don't doubt they believe some of that, but I think it's also a negotiating tactic to tell the army that the costs of any military coup would be very high.
At the same time, Shadi Hamid, there were tweets overnight, at least reports of them, that the cabinet, members of Morsi's own cabinet, had abandoned him and joined the popular movement. I don't know that we know the exact source of those tweets, but they also seem to suggest that some of his own support inside the government is leaving him.
Yes, there's been a number of cabinet ministers who have already resigned, but it's worth keeping in mind that none of them are from the Muslim Brotherhood. They are technocrats, or actually some are bureaucrats from the older regime under Mubarak. So there aren't any internal splits within the Muslim Brotherhood itself at this point.
Trying to understand the Egyptian population a little better, Shadi Hamid, we see the images and we hear the sound of protests in Tahrir Square and in other cities. For every protester who wants Morsi to go, I assume there has to be another person who's not in the streets who voted for the Muslim Brotherhood, they won the election, who's thinking, we don't want another revolution.
Yes. Well, Egypt is very divided. You know, it's hard to say whether it's half-half, but it's very polarized into these two camps. And it pretty much comes down to pro-brotherhood or anti-brotherhood at this point. And even within the opposition itself, you don't have a clear leadership. It's a headless opposition with very different groups and factions within it. So they might all hate Morsi and the Brotherhood, but they don't really know what they're for. They're not agreeing on a particular roadmap going forward because they do have real differences among them.
And at the same time, before we let you go, Shadi Hamid, it seems that the United States has tied hands here. The White House put out a readout of a call between President Obama and Morsi, which really suggested a distance keeping from the White House, not wanting to tie their fate to really any of the factions in Egypt right now.
Yes, the Obama administration is hedging its bets. It doesn't know how this is going to turn out. And there's a lot of anti-U.S. sentiment now in Egypt where the opposition is accusing the U.S. of backing the Brotherhood. So I think the U.S. is more sensitive to that now. That said, U.S. officials have also suggested that a military coup would be a sort of red line and could lead to a loss of military aid. And there are actually legal provisions that would require the U.S. to terminate military assistance in the event of a military coup. So the question is, will it be considered a military coup if it happens by the U.S.? And that's why I think the military would be, if they're thinking ahead and thinking intelligently, they wouldn't want it to be too blatant. They'd want it to have a civilian veneer so they can claim plausible deniability and say, yeah, we intervened, but it wasn't a coup.
Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center from Doha, Qatar, joins us. Thank you, Shadi.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Turning to Washington now, a major part of President Obama's signature domestic law, the initiative that could very well shape his legacy, is now on hold for one more year. As big parts of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, are being rolled out, the administration announced that a requirement that larger employers provide health coverage is being postponed until 2015, which by no accident happens to be after next year's midterm elections. Now, the mandate, as I said, requires these larger companies to cover workers with health care or face penalties. But now the White House says not yet. The delay, meanwhile, has been welcomed by large employer groups and, of course, by Republicans. Joining us now is Jeffrey Young, healthcare reporter at The Huffington Post. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Jeff, Republicans, of course, are saying, told you so. Obamacare is a train wreck, and this proves it. The White House says we're just listening to employers and trying to help them out with a complicated law. Neither of those things is probably completely true.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of two big things going on here. The first, it touches on what you were just saying, is that this looks very bad. The administration is only about 3 months away from when the health insurance exchanges are supposed to open, and those are the online or telephone marketplaces for people to buy insurance if they don't get it at work. And there's been some doubt about whether those would be ready on time. There's been delays of a few other less significant provisions. And now this comes along. It looks like maybe they're not on track to get this thing set up in time. But the flip side of that is this particular provision, while important, you know, by trying to at the minimum make sure that employers aren't dropping their workers from their benefit plans. The reality is that for next year, and that's when this delay is going to be in force, it probably won't have that much of a practical effect. Something like 94 or 95% of the companies subject to this rule, that is those who have at least 50 employees, are already offering health benefits. And in almost all those cases, the benefits meet the law standards already, on top of which the Congressional Budget Office and other people projecting the effects of the healthcare law didn't expect in the short term lots of employers to start signing up workers that are not currently covered because of these rules. So it's an odd situation in a way where the politics of this look very bad, and it could be a negative sign of things to come for the rest of the law. But if it's not, and the rest of the law goes forward the way that it's supposed to, this delay won't affect that many individual people. But it will free these companies for a year from some administrative burdens.
then the question is, what are the chances if the Obama administration is delaying this for a year because it's too complicated or employers are carping too much? What are the chances that they deal this provision away entirely? It's not the great big individual mandate. It's kind of a smaller part of the law. Maybe the White House eventually says it's too much trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we'll have to wait and see. There was some speculation immediately after this came out yesterday that, well, if the business community can lobby this thing away for a year, what else can they for a year? Or can they lobby this thing away for more than a year? Maybe that's the case. Maybe the White House doesn't care about this part of the law as much as it does other ones, or maybe the business community just has that much influence. But, you know, let's not foreclose the possibility that this really is just a one-year delay because the computer systems at the government level maybe weren't ready and because companies weren't really sure what was demanded of them. What the Treasury Department said yesterday, and business groups responding to the delay basically said the same thing is, oh, geez, you know, the paperwork burden here is more than we thought. The regulations aren't out yet. Companies didn't really know what to do. And from a big business standpoint, if you look at this and you go, well, geez, we're already giving our employers health insurance. Why do we have to go to all this trouble to rush to get the reporting requirements all set up in time when the government's computer systems maybe aren't ready either? It seems like a pragmatic decision, and that's the way that it was described by one business lobbyist I talked to yesterday. But as you said, I mean, under the surface, there could be more to this, and we're just going to have to dig away and find out.
Sure. Plenty of pragmatism, perhaps, for the business community and for the White House. On the other hand, major politics for Republicans who are planning to use frustration with Obamacare in the 2014 election. And this one looks like it's right over the middle of the plate for Republicans who call this bill a disaster. Jeff Young, healthcare reporter at Huffington Post. You can follow him on Twitter at Jeff Young. Jeff, thanks. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. As fires rage on, residents of Yarnell in Arizona wait for the green light to head home and assess the damage. Along with hundreds of houses they've lost, this community is reeling from the loss of life, the death of 19 firefighters.
This family's lost. The Prescott Fire Department lost. The city of Prescott lost. The state of Arizona and the nation. Because these were the best.
That's the voice of Don Davendorf, fire marshal in Prescott, Arizona. Those 19 firefighters killed Sunday leave behind devastated families and colleagues. Now the process of healing begins for the community. Joining me now is Matt Mumma, a former hotshot with the San Juan Hotshots. He's just arrived in Arizona to counsel firefighters and their families with critical incident stress management. Hi, Matt.
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Also with us is Liz Kinney, volunteer at the Wildfire Firefighter Foundation, which provides assistance to families of firefighters killed and injured in the line of duty. Hi, Liz.
Hi there.
Matt, let me start with you, since you are a former hotshot yourself, and there are hotshot crews throughout the nation that fight these wildfires. What insight can you give us about what may have gone wrong in this tragic case where 19 hotshots lost their lives?
I think one of the biggest key factors that seems to be coming out is they had a pretty drastic change in the weather that essentially took them by surprise, and they got in a spot that they couldn't get out of. You know, you try and put as many safeguards in place as you can, and sometimes things change unpredictably and people are caught off guard, and that's what happened here. So it's not necessarily that there wasn't enough done. It was just that circumstances beyond control.
And the actual work when they're near these blazes fighting the fires, Matt, what are these people essentially doing? Digging ditches as fast as they can in blazing heat and clearing brush, just trying to sort of build fire lines around the blaze areas?
Essentially, yeah. The fire line itself is a pretty simple process. It's simplistic in the sense that you are trying to clear enough brush to get down to basically dirt and create a bit of a break in the fuels that stops the fire.
Try to put a ring around it so it can't spread.
Basically, yeah.
Okay. Well, Liz Kinney with the Wildland Firefighter Foundation, I want to turn to you. We see images of television, still photos of the young men who died in these fires. Have you ever dealt with something on this scale, however?
Yes, I have, unfortunately. I think it started back in 1994 with our Storm King, where we lost so many hotshots. and smoke jumpers in Colorado. And it's a big process to go through to provide the support for the families to help them through this process. The impact is very hard, and it's very long term. It's not just here's the fire, here's the aftermath, and then everybody goes home and the families are left. It's about long term support and care of the families as they work through this process. The grief is different for everybody.
Matt Mumma, you're involved in counseling these families with critical incident stress management now, and you've just arrived in Arizona. What about the similarity that my mind goes to military families or soldiers killed in action? Is that a similarity that exists? This is an extremely tight-knit community like the military. The fellas are the same age. That's what my mind goes to. What do you think?
I'd say it's a fairly safe parallel to draw. Being on a hotshot crew is... you know, we often refer to it as a summer family. You know, you essentially eat, sleep, live together in a truck driving all over the West. So you get to know each other very, very well, and you spend essentially all of your time together. So it's very much a family. And, you know, the supports that stand behind us are our families, who often become very close as well. And I certainly can't say enough for my own family and the support that they've given me. And I know any of my brothers and sisters out there that are firefighters would say the same thing. So it's definitely a very, very difficult time, and I would assume fairly similar.
Matt, the family of a soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan, unfortunately, always has in the back of their mind that that young person might not return home. Firefighting is dangerous, but it's not war. And I wonder if you confront an element of surprise with families that they just never expected their son or brother or boyfriend or husband to be killed on a job like this. It's not a war after all.
I would agree. You know, there's always a bit of danger involved. I mean, it is an unpredictable and high risk job. I guess I would go so far to say that I'd hope nobody expects to lose a loved one in war or in fire. But it's certainly something that happens.
Liz Kinney, with the Wildland Firefighter Foundation, can you give us a sense after this horrible tragedy and the scale of it, what your operation with families or on the ground looks like right now?
Well, what we'll try and do is work with the families to find out what their immediate needs are. For example, remember, these are mostly young. I think the average age was 27, so they're young families, and maybe this was their only breadwinner in the family. And so maybe they are not quite able to provide. And so the wildland firefighters will come in, and maybe they'll go out and they'll do the grocery shopping for them. Maybe they'll pay the electric bill just to keep them going. So immediately they're right there to provide assistance that they need. And then long term, they'll, after the last casserole dish is cleaned up and put away, the Wildland Firefighter Foundation will still be there to provide support. One of the things that they do is bring in other families that have gone through losing a loved one, a firefighter. It's a huge support group. They'll bring in other families to provide support to these new families and help them through the process. But it's an ongoing thing. It's some of the families that are still involved or go all the way back to Storm King, which was in 1994. So it's a big community, a big group, and the Wildland Firefighter Foundation works hard to keep these people all together and provide support for each other.
Liz Kinney is a volunteer with the Wildland Firefighter Foundation in Arizona, providing assistance to families. Matt Mumma is a former hotshot himself with the San Juan Hotshots in Arizona as well, helping to counsel and help families with the Critical Incident Stress Management Group. Thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
You can send us your thoughts about the folks and families in Arizona recovering from the loss of life and the loss of their homes. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can weigh in on this conversation or anything else that you hear on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Coming up, remembering Congressman William Gray, a civil rights pioneer who passed away at 71. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm one of those who was born in the transition period of America. I grew up in a segregated America. I remember having a drink at the colored water fountain. I remember when I couldn't stay at a hotel in the South.
That's the voice of William H. Gray, Baptist minister, congressman, activist, and the highest-ranking black lawmaker in the country. Passed away on Monday in London. He was 71 years of age. While serving in the House from 1979 to 1991, Congressman Gray was a persistent voice for equal rights, benefits, services for the poor, and education. President Obama released a statement yesterday calling Bill Gray a trailblazer. Now, in 1991, William Gray, after leaving Congress, became president and chief executive of the United Negro College Fund, a position he held until 2004. And this is amazing. According to the fund's website, in those 13 years, Gray raised over $2.4 billion for the United Negro College Fund. Joining us now is Congressman Shaka Fattah, Democrat from Philadelphia. William Gray, also from Philadelphia and a Democrat. Congressman, hello.
How are you? I have the burden of serving in the seat that Bill Gray made famous around the world, because as the congressman from Philadelphia, he really created change everywhere from the South African Divestiture Act to his chairmanship of the Budget Committee, the work he did on transportation as a member of the Appropriations Committee. But he's finally remembered here not so much as a politician. There are many people who remember him as the pastor of a church that his father started, and that he was the senior pastor and traveled home every Sunday to preach, and he conducted weddings and funerals and baptisms for children. So he was a person who could interact with presidents, but he never lost the common touch.
Congressman Shaka Fattah, Democrat of Philadelphia, in the very seat that William H. Gray used to hold, and that's why we wanted to have you on, Congressman. Congressman Gray talked about in life, talked about transcending in Congress sort of the perception of a black congressman who stands up for black constituents and being something more, a leader on the Budget Committee who can broker deals for the whole country, not just for a narrow constituency.
He was the most extraordinary member, in the sense that he could reach members in every part of the Congress, whatever the geography, no matter how conservative they may be or different in terms of their perspective on the world. He was known for putting together these coalitions, and every year he would pass a budget and actually played a leadership role in the budget summit that eventually moved the country on a fiscal footing that people say set the stage for the balanced budgets that took place under the Clinton years.
Before we let you go, Congressman Shaka Fattah, the calls, the emails that I know you're getting now, they must be pouring in because you knew him so well and you hold his seat. Give us a flavor of what the memories, what the sentiment is like for William H. Gray.
Well, people are celebrating his life and his legacy, mourning his passing, but appreciating the fact that we had a chance to see a great man on the world stage, but also a great man right here at home in Philadelphia.
That is Congressman Shaka Fattah, Democrat of Pennsylvania, holding the very seat once occupied by William H. Gray. William H. Gray dead at 71 in London. Before we go, let's hear in his own words William H. Gray talking about education.
We are going to prosper, all of us, as we face the challenge from Europe and the Pacific Rim. We've got to do something. What's the best way I found to do that? Education. Education. Education.
Former Democratic whip and budget leader William H. Gray, dead at 71. We turn now to Fort Lauderdale in Florida, where just days after the Supreme Court delivered a legal milestone in the form of a ruling striking down the Defense of Marriage Act, Trey Popov and Julian Marsh celebrated a personal milestone of their own. Friday was Julian's 55th birthday, and in the middle of birthday dinner at Red Lobster, Trey got an email with some big news, and here it is. He was approved for a green card petition, now allowing them to apply officially for a green card, immigration status, in the United States. That decision made Trey and Julian the first same-sex married couple to be approved to apply for permanent resident visa in America. And although they still have some paperwork to go through and procedural processes to follow, Julian and Trey said they're just glad to be subject to the same rules and regulations as straight couples in this country.
That's what we think is the amazing thing. Now we're treated like everybody else, which is all anybody wanted in the first place.
Okay, let's take a step back for a moment and describe your birthday dinner and how this email came through and how you felt. How did it all go down?
We were kind of like, what? What is going on? And to be totally honest, it really took like about 2 days before everything sunk in, before all the emotions came out. So it took us a while, but we just kind of broke down yesterday and looked at each other and really, you know, all the emotion came out because we've been overwhelmed. And I don't know if you can hear the emotion in my voice, but it's very, very touching what's been going on.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you guys in terms of applying for your status. Now, you've been informed that you may apply just like everybody else. Did the immigration authority or the State Department or whoever it is reach out to you because you had an application pending? And this is very quickly after the DOMA decision. Who reached out to you? Was it your lawyer or where did this come from?
This is Trey speaking. The decision went to the lawyer, and we're expecting the same notice in the mail, but we haven't received it yet.
Now, Trey and Julian, you're in Florida right now.
Yes.
So you're not legally married in Florida because gay marriage is not recognized, nor is it legal in Florida. In what jurisdiction were you married?
Well, we knew we couldn't get married in Florida. So we went to New York. We actually got married in Brooklyn in a civic building. And we had both had ties to Brooklyn. I worked there for 10 years and Trey had friends. And it felt great. We spent a really great weekend and we came home and it hits you as soon as you get home. Oh, our state doesn't recognize we're married. So, you know, in the eyes of New York, we're married. In the eyes of the federal government, we're married. And we come back to Florida and we're second-class citizens. We're not married. We could go to Canada and we're married. We could go to Spain and we're married. We could go to Israel and we're married. But in our own state, we're not married. And we're really angry about it.
You know, a lot of legal experts, after reading these Supreme Court rulings in the Prop 8 decision and in the DOMA decision, think that cases like yours, it's just a matter of time before somebody sues to bring a case like yours to court, which is to say, we're legally married in the state of New York. We live in another state. And rights we have in one state are not recognized in another state, and that's not constitutional, and that case is probably coming.
Yes, and hopefully we'll be part of that. We will do whatever we can to help our cause, that's for sure, and help other people in the same situation. We're willing to do whatever we can do. That's the best I can say. We really are. And when they picked up our piece of paper and processed it, they got the right two guys because we're really willing.
The right two guys you mentioned, and that's interesting. Before we let you go, Trey Popov and Julian Marsh, I doubt that when you started this process or wanted to get immigration status or even got married in New York that you thought you were going to be a first in this whole thing. But it turns out you're a first. You're going to be the first gay couple to have legal immigration status through a spouse relationship. That's something.
It's huge. And the number of people that have reached out to us proves it. I'm not talking about one or two or three people. We're talking about probably by now hundreds of people have asked us how we did this. It's truly, truly overwhelming. And we're dealing with the best we can.
Well, a lot more attention to come because you are a first and this country is changing too. That's Trey Popov and Julian Marsh, the first gay couple in America to qualify for legal immigration status through their marriage. Gentlemen, keep in touch and just let us know if the green card goes smoothly, okay?
We sure will.
I'm Todd Zwillick. 50 years have passed since the Equal Pay Act was signed into law, and the intention there was eliminating pay disparity. And yet, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, last year women earned just 81% of the salaries of their similarly situated male counterparts. Now, on this issue, there's been no shortage of advice for women this year, especially from Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg. In her book, Lean In, she urged women to get better at negotiating their salaries and to plan their career trajectories more effectively. And that set off a media and cultural firestorm on the issue of female empowerment in the workplace. But our guest says one important issue has been left out of this discussion, mandatory wage disclosure in the private sector, where 9 in 10 of us work. She argues that when powerful women like Sheryl Sandberg focus on women's lagging negotiating skills, they're blaming the women for the wage gap when the true culprit is wage secrecy. Marianne Kulo is chair of the Department of Law, Taxation, and Financial Planning at Bentley University. Hi, Professor.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining us. Wage secrecy, it sounds pretty simple. Is there a way to force bosses in the private sector to disclose wages? It certainly would make it easier for everybody to know where they stand.
Yes, it would. There is a way. Whether there's the political will to achieve it is a more complicated question. There are numerous statutes that require public employers to disclose the salaries of their employees, both on the federal and the state level. There is, therefore, a pretty easy solution, which is to copy those requirements into the Paycheck Fairness Act and require them of private sector employers as well.
Well, secrecy, of course, it's easy to see how wage secrecy helps keep people divided and drives down wages. But it seems to me that secrecy would affect women and men equally. A man who doesn't know what other people in the workplace make also can't say, I need to make as much as Joe, or I need to make a dollar more than Joe. So how do we know that it's not negotiating skills and planning your trajectory, the kind of things that Sheryl Sandberg talked about, and in fact it's secrecy that's harming women in terms of their wage fairness?
Okay, great question. First of all, it absolutely affects anybody who is being unfairly paid, male or female. My objection to the focus on women's negotiation deficiencies is not that they don't exist, it's that it shifts the focus of the public conversation away from the fact that we already have three federal statutes that require employers to pay men and women who are engaged in equivalent work equally. Equal Pay Act, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and now the Lilly Ledbetter Act. And when we talk about negotiation, it sounds like employers only make decisions about what they pay in reaction to what employees ask for. And while that may be true in practice, legally, it doesn't relieve them of the obligation to make sure that they're paying people equitably. And you would not be able to defend yourself in court by saying, oh, well, the reason I pay Sally $10,000 less than Joe is because Sally never asked for the extra money. And when we focus on negotiating, we also have to remember that you can only negotiate from strength if you have all the information, right? Any negotiation teacher will tell you that first thing you do is do your homework. So if I'm going in to negotiate for myself, I'm probably just going to be looking for a merit raise, which is whatever the current percentage is in my industry and my company, based on last year's salary. That's quite different from going in and asking for an equitable adjustment, because I just found out that somebody who's doing comparable work is making substantially more than I am. So without this information, the negotiation itself, even if you perfect the skill, you're not playing with a full deck.
And then from the employer's perspective, since there's not an employer in this conversation, boy, if I'm the employer or the guy writing out the paychecks, I absolutely don't want to have to disclose every negotiation when it comes to salary. I mean, even to people who are doing comparable work, you might justify a different salary based on different amounts of merit or on how long you might want them to stick around in the company. There might be legitimate reasons for an employer to want to pay somebody else more, even if the work is comparable.
This is true. And there are models for addressing that. The model that I actually propose in the paper I've just published is modeled on the federal model, but it allows for annotation by the employer of education, experience, seniority, production, other reasons that might explain what appear to be on their face otherwise illegitimate pay discrepancies. The other thing about this, Todd, is that employers do have that initial reaction, but in truth, if you start looking at it more carefully, there's actually evidence to the contrary. There's a big 2008 survey of 10,000 employees that actually demonstrates that salary disclosure is good for the bottom line, that it increases employee intent to stay by 34%, and it increases worker effort by 15%. And some employers are starting to listen to that and do this voluntarily in the private sector.
Yeah, who's doing this in the private sector in a way that works or doesn't work?
The flagship operation on this is Whole Foods. They do complete transparency. Anyone who works in any part of the Whole Foods organization, from the corner store to the corporate office, has access to a notebook that contains the last year's salary information, complete compensation information for every other employee by name. And they can access that information at any time. Now, the reason I focus on Whole Foods is that they are repeatedly chosen as one of the 100 best companies to work for. They have very high employee morale, and they've implemented this system with virtually no cost. There are other companies. Dell and Costco have been written up quite a bit recently. They don't have quite the 100% transparency. They do the posting a little bit more anonymously. They post information more by bands. But more and more companies are kind of moving this way.
We will be waiting to see if disclosure across employers starts to lead to better pay equity. That's the point. Marianne Kulo, chair of the Department of Law, Taxation, and Financial Planning at Bentley University. Professor, in the spirit of full disclosure, I know you see this question coming. You want to tell us how much you made last year?
I'm not sure I want to do that on public radio.
All right. Well, Professor Marianne Kulo, again, chair of the Department of Law, Taxation, and Financial Planning at Bentley University, advocate for public disclosure of salaries. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. Well, kicking off the long July 4th weekend, we have an early movie date day here on The Takeaway. Not on Friday as usual, but it's Wednesday. The film that's grabbing all the attention this holiday weekend, of course, is Disney's remake of The Lone Ranger. It tells the story of how John Reed came to be the man behind the mask, and it stars Johnny Depp as Tonto, Armie Hammer as the Lone Ranger himself. As always, our Movie Date team, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, are here to weigh in. Rafer, of course, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen is culture producer for The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hi, hey, Todd.
You can hear all of Kristen and Rafer's movie reviews on the Movie Date podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Guys, welcome once again.
Hi.
Thanks.
Let's start off here to hear a little bit of a clip from Disney's version of The Lone Ranger from Jerry Bruckheimer. This is the team that brought us Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm sort of expecting something similar here. I expect it to be a lot different from the black and white that I used to watch. Let's listen.
Eyes cut by the bullets that killed him. From the great beyond, he will protect you and the ones you love.
You want me to wear a mask?
The men you seek think you are dead, Kimosabe. Better to stay that way.
The unmistakable voice of Johnny Depp. He has amazing plasticity in his voice, but you can really tell that it's him. Rafer, what'd you think?
You know, I seem to be one of the few critics around that enjoyed this film.
Okay.
I thought the character of Tonto, with all his elaborate makeup, worked. You know, he's playing the smarter, wiser member of the team this time. It's overstuffed. There's a lot going on. 2.5 hours. It tries to do more than it should, I think. But I enjoyed all the imagination and the detail, and I actually wound up having a pretty good time.
Kristen Meinzer, Rafer enjoyed the movie.
And I'm like the rest of the critics out there, where I thought that it had some problems. 2.5 hours, way too long. Not enough adventure, not enough fun. There's a great train chase in the beginning, a great train chase in the end, and in between, it's two men with very flawed histories who've made a lot of mistakes, who are helping each other through those mistakes. Tonto has some problems. Lone Ranger has some problems. And we spend a lot of time just thinking about their problems with them while they talk about their problems.
Even in a mediocre movie, Johnny Depp and his stardom and his quality as an actor sometimes pulls it through, but not in this case.
He's delicious, and I'm always going to love Johnny Depp, but they could have trimmed half an hour, as is the case with lots of Johnny Depp movies.
Well, Johnny Depp, of course, plays Tonto, and there's a broader discussion that we wanted to have here because Johnny Depp is not a Native American. He might have a shred of Native American, as we understand it.
Cherokee.
He says he has a shred.
But he
plays Tonto, and this, of course, raises an issue of Hollywood casting non-Native Americans, people who are not completely Native American or even a half or a quarter, in the role of Native Americans. And I want to bring in Adrian Keene. Adrian is blogger and activist with the website Native Appropriations. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And we're glad to have you. Now, you heard the review of The Lone Ranger, which is good enough. But this issue of casting Johnny Depp, now he says he's a shred Cherokee, Rafe, what you said?
Cherokee or Creek, apparently.
Yeah, he goes back and forth on
Cherokee or Creek. Yeah. The world knows Johnny Depp as a white guy. And I want to turn to you and sort of get your take on this long tradition of Hollywood casting white guys in the role of Native Americans.
Yeah, I mean, it's been something that has been going on since the earliest days of Hollywood, from the early Western films. And clearly it's a tradition that has carried on to the present day and is extremely problematic for any number of reasons.
Well, did they improve on it at all in this case? I mean, one thing that that Kristen and Rafer mentioned is that Tonto's not really the follower in this case. He's really the leader, the thought leader in this movie. Does that matter at all?
I think on some level it's important that the sort of sidekick role was reimagined, but I think the egregious stereotypes that Tonto plays into kind of outweighs that good that was done of switching up the relationship between the Lone Ranger and Tonto.
Well, I'm going to ask you for some examples, but before you do, it used to be even more egregious potentially. Let's go back to the 1950s and the old Lone Ranger TV show for how it used to be.
Him dead, Kemosabe, but me glad. Him deserve to die.
No, Tonto. No one should have his life end like this.
Better him dead. Like white parsons say, this act of providence. Now no one know you still live.
Adrian Keene with Native Appropriations. Disney's version of the Lone Ranger might be problematic, but that, what we just played, is downright cringeworthy.
See, I don't see a lot of difference between the two, personally.
Interesting. Why not?
I think the Tonto speak, the broken English, is something that has been a stereotype that has stuck with the Native community since the first Lone Ranger. And to me, to have the new Tonto, quote unquote, still play into that stereotype is really harmful, and still paints that picture of Native peoples as inferior or lesser, even if Johnny Depp's Tonto has more agency and more of a bigger role in this film.
Well, hang in there, Adrian Keene. Rafer and Kristen, let me turn to you, Rafer, first. You both saw this film, and I know that you were watching it with an eye towards this, probably. You know, you're both minorities yourself, not American
True.
Indians.
Mm-hmm.
Rafer, an improvement in the portrayal of a Native American in this film? Has Hollywood made some progress, or as cringeworthy as Adrian thinks?
I think the film is trying, and in my opinion, I think it succeeds to turn a few of these things on its head. You know, Tonto is the smarter of the two. He does speak in some pidgin, but he also slips into regular English when sort of the bad white guys aren't looking. You know, he plays dumb with the pidgin English. There's a nod, I think, a lot of very clear nods to what the settlers did, to what the white Americans did in wiping out these tribes. They pay a lot of attention to that in the film. You know, whether it works for everyone or not, I don't know, but I think I felt like the film had the right intentions.
Kristen, apart from the fact that you didn't like the movie, is it an improvement, do you think, on these grounds?
You know, I think something that Rafer said earlier is what's really happening here is Johnny Depp is doing that same sort of caricature he does in Pirates of the Caribbean and a lot of the other movies he's in. He's almost playing a cartoon character in some ways. And because he's playing a cartoon character in some ways, it might be easier to let him off the hook and not think about, is this realistic, is this authentic, or is this fair? But the bigger issue I have is this would have been such a great opportunity for a minority to be cast in a minority role. And as someone who's a minority who frequently sees the minorities wiped out of the movies, I would have really loved to have seen a high-profile Native American actor get a chance here.
Perhaps a missed opportunity for Disney. Then again, a minority actor does not have the kind of box office power that Johnny Depp has, and there's no way around that. Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer are Movie Date critics. You can always subscribe to their podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. And Adrian Keene, blogger and activist with Native Appropriations. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, Johnny Depp's salary for making The Lone Ranger has not been made public, and that's too bad. We would have wanted to talk about that because we are talking about whether making salaries public would make it easier to negotiate for equal pay.
Having that out in the open, I'm not sure. I don't see that as a thing. I feel like people would bicker more and compare themselves to others and the performance, and I just don't see it as a good thing.
A listener in Amber, Pennsylvania thinks, it depends. I have been with my company for 15 years, and some might consider me overpaid. especially since I do not have a college degree. You can weigh in on this or any other topic that you hear on the show at 8778-MYTAKE. And we want you to get an early jump on all of our conversations. Be part of our listener response network by signing up for our texts. You can get one text per day where we'll ask you a question featured on the next day's show. That's so that your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Have a wonderful 4th. You know, in our family, the 4th means the eve of July 3rd, my mom's birthday. Happy birthday, Mom. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.